here. The board is a very creative and innovative board, so we appreciate the opportunity in this beautiful house to be talking about issues that concern all of us in our daily lives, and have concerned us in the past and will concern us in the future. The conception of this series of three talks was based on conversations that we had about the place we live, the world we live in, and our environment, and thinking about how we as citizens can learn to take actions without polarizing our communities, how we can all protect the place that we love, the river, the water, the air, etc. And so we see a common thread through all of these three presentations, starting with David Gardens today. David, most of you have seen the email and the publicity that went around. David has written about the Hudson and the myths of the dredging issue in the Hudson for Harper's. He's a writer who has a very wonderful career. He's written for GQ. He's written for Harper's extensively. He's currently, he doesn't only write on the environment, he's currently working on an issue that I suspect would be of interest and concern to many people here, probably all of us, and that is the issue of the Tea Party and militia movements. So we look forward to having his same insights and analytical thinking on that issue, but we also have been able to benefit, will benefit today from his insights on the whole question of dredging in the Hudson and GE. I hope that we see that story that he's about to tell as a cautionary tale for all of us, for what we need to anticipate moving forward, and I hope we will learn the lessons, maybe not once and for all, but maybe once again. So without going any further, you can see David's work on his website at www.davidgardiel.com, and thank you all for coming. Please.
Or didn't they say it was a bad idea? to their minds, the water quality issue was sufficient to sign the story. But I soon realized the story was much larger. The project was being hailed as the vanguard of remedial science. Interim EPA Region 2 Administrator George Pavlou had declared the dredging of the Hudson River as a symbol of victory for the environment. I believe the grandiosity of their claims granted me license to check under the hood, see if they were credible, and so the scope of my investigation expanded accordingly. Pavlou's enthusiasm certainly wasn't an isolated case. Many had long considered the dredging of the Hudson and the cleanup of the Hudson the holy grail of the environmental movement. For the simple reason that on one side you had a national treasure, and on the other, a quintessential American conglomerate, General Electric, which was even more of a juggernaut here in New York State than it was inside the Beltway, which is hard to imagine. So the thinking among environmentalists at the time was, if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere. When I wrote my cover story, I was writing for a national audience, so I reached back in time to try and conjure the Hudson's centrality in the American imagination, to give context of how explorers, empires, colonists, and then citizens interacted with it over time. Its evolution from object of wonder to mere means, from appreciation to utilization, and then full-blown industrialization. I'll spare you folks that, as well as my rehashing of the epic battle that was waged between GE, DEC, and EPA, upriver residents and downriver residents, and try and stick as much as possible to the facts of this particular case as I found them on the eve of dredging in the spring of last year. But before we get too far along, you may wonder what PCBs are and what GE was doing with them. PCBs are amber oils about the viscosity of maple syrup, slippery. They're made up of 1 to 10 chlorine molecules bound to a biphenyl ring. They were long hailed as miraculous for their inflammability and resilience. Chemical anthropologists will be finding them thousands of years from now, assuming we're still here. Their toxicity was well established by the 1930s, and no level of safe exposure has been set for cancer or non-cancer health risks. All that's known is more is worse. This is unfortunate because until they were banned in 1977, PCBs were of use nearly everywhere electricity could be found, due to their utility as insulators, especially in wire, transformer, and capacitors. The oils were therefore ubiquitous, an effective fix for preventing electrical fires and other disruptions, enabling much of modern life's ease, particularly the portion abetted by General Electric. In Hudson Falls and Fort Edward, adjacent towns, stacked along the river's eastern bank, 50 miles north of Albany, GE used PCBs to make capacitors, which are electronic circuits used in almost everything with an on-off switch. One of their primary functions is blocking direct current while allowing alternating current to pass. So with few exceptions, media accounts of the Hudson River fiasco begin as follows. From the end of World War II until 1977, GE legally discharged 1.3 million pounds of PCBs into the river from its plants at Hudson Falls and Fort Edward. No less than three major fallacies are thusly perpetuated, and we'll cover all of them in due course. The proposed cleanup would remove 2.65 million cubic yards of sediment containing roughly 250,000 pounds of PCBs from 490 acres of riverbed. During negotiations with GE, the EPA had made it the novel concession of splitting the project into two phases. First of which was said to be a pilot, covering a 4-mile stretch from Fort Edward to the Thompson Island Dam, a reach that's referred to as the Thompson, or known as the Thompson Island Pool. With phase two entailing 90% of the actual work. So again, phase one, just a pilot, essentially. And that's what concluded last November. EPA and GE claimed near omniscience regarding the PCB mix in the river, citing 50,000 core samples that had been extracted in the riverbed prior to the issuance in 2002 of their record of decision, the document in which the agency detailed the problem's scope, its attendant risks, and selected a remedy, which was the dredging remedy. Now, first off, as I began my research, I wanted to get a handle on this 1.3 million pounds number, because it was everywhere, it was in the record of decision, in nearly every newspaper clipping, etc., and I've read reams of reports and still couldn't tell where it came from, what its basis in fact was. When I asked John Haggard, who is GE's remedial chief engineer, where the number came from, he laughed awkwardly. We've never actually done an estimate, GE spokesman Mark B and his handler had interjected. That's a regulator's number, being continued, referring to the EPA. Unfortunately, the regulator's answer was no better. That was before I got here, said EPA Hudson River Project Manager Dave King. So I have no idea. I don't even know how you would come up with that. But GE knew, or at least had the means to make an educated guess. An internal GE memo from 1969 entitled PCB, an industry problem, states that the capacitor division used 10 million pounds annually, quote, probably more than the rest of the company combined, end quote, and discloses that only 9 million pounds could be accounted for in terms of product shipped. So if we were to believe the findings in GE's own internal memorandum, we take into account that the industrial power capacitor division operated for about 30 years. Suddenly we're talking about 30 million pounds of PCBs unaccounted for in the Hudson River, in the vicinity of Hudson Falls and Fort Edward, not 1.3 million. Big difference. As a side note here, during the fact-checking process, when the Harper's editor tasked with looking over my shoulder and verifying all the facts in the piece called Mark Bean and asked him about this memo, Mark Bean cautioned that it might be a shrewd forgery or inauthentic in some way, like George W. Bush's phony National Guard documents or something. But when the story came out, they never challenged the legitimacy or accuracy of the document. And even without the memo's revelations, the fact that 1.6 million pounds, that's 1.6 billion pounds, of pure pyranol, which was GE's trade name for PCBs, had been discovered under one parking lot at the southeastern corner of the Fort Edward plant, proved to me that the 1.3 million figure was inaccurate. So again, they were saying 1.3 million was the total. We got 1.6 million under a single parking lot at the plant, right across from McDonald's and right across from the residential neighborhood. So this lowball tally, intentionally or not, served two functions. It furthered the myth that GE's discharges were discrete, controlled acts, and exaggerated regulators' grasp of the situation. The truth of the matter was that there are more PCBs in the Hudson River Basin than almost anywhere else in the United States, with an estimate, courtesy of Scenic Hudson, of 7.2 million pounds divvied among the watershed's 25 known repositories, 15 of which the New York State DEC has designated Class 2, indicating significant threats requiring action, and 20 of them boasting mobile, totally unencumbered contamination. At the suggestion of Bob Boyle, the original riverkeeper who broke the PCB story in Sports Illustrated back in 1970, I contacted Walter Hang, the principal of Toxics Targeting, an environmental data company in Ithaca, New York. Hang's interest in the Hudson was longstanding. He co-authored an early study on regulatory controls of wastewater discharge to the river, titled Troubled Waters, in 1977. The New York Public Interest Research Group veteran, Hank spent 12 years directing their toxics project before joining the private sector, where he's also driven $90 million in remedial efforts, largely pro bono, mostly in the area surrounding his hometown of Ithaca. Hank aggregates every hazardous release in New York State, coalescing local, state, and federal information into spatially accurate, thoroughly unsettling maps commissioned by real estate firms doing due diligence. We started talking, and I told him that I thought the scale of contamination in the Thompson Island pool, the plant sites, and the towns themselves might be greater than regulators or GE acknowledged. I also told him that I've been to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where the Housatonic River glides past GE's mothball transformer division, and GE and EPA had set a rather alarming precedent. After being ignored for years, in 1997, discovery of PCBs at a children's park in Pittsfield made the Housatonic's plight sexy enough for the evening news. engendering sufficient resolve to dredge two of the river's 140 miles in 2001 with GE springing for the first half mile. Yet loose toxins still saturate the banks, and storm drains in the vicinity are currently contributing PCBs to that particular stretch of the Housatonic. PCBs they did dredge were dumped in a landfill that abuts a schoolyard, that abuts a shuttered power plant, that abuts a TSCA, or Toxic Substances Control Act, dump, which rounds out the Chernobyl motif quite well. In any case, I told Hang that all this made me skeptical about the dredging. Hang felt the same way. "I really care about cleaning crap up," he explained when we first spoke on the phone. "I want to set the policy back to what it originally was, source removal. They've got to dig till they don't find the contamination anymore, extract the stuff from the environment, and permanently sequester it. The entire remedial program from coast to coast has really been more akin to what I call interim remedial measures, the letter and the spirit of the law never fulfilled." A decade ago, Hang had trained his eyes on the Hudson, on GE's plant sites in particular, and discovered that there was a half-mile, quote, free-floating product plume, end quote, of pure PCBs leaking into the river from the bedrock beneath the Hudson Falls plant. He was fairly confident in his findings, but cautioned that his data was 10 years old, and he would need more recent reports from DEC to fully delineate the contamination. Walter believed that a state FOIL request in his name would set off alarms in Albany, and so it was my job to interact with the project manager at DEC and get as much information as I could and pass it on to Ithaca. Now, why DEC, you may wonder? Rightly so. As it turns out, the two GE plants in Hudson Falls and Fort Edward are not part of the Hudson River Superfund site. DEC, New York State DEC, a state agency, is the lead agency handling remedial efforts there, and they have very little power to compel GE to do much of anything. More on this in a minute. I soon found out that, by DEC's own admission, quote, "PCBs flow directly from the Hudson Falls site through rock fractures to the Hudson River. At Fort Edward, where GE's former outfall pipe met the eastern bank of the Hudson, PCB contamination had traveled hundreds of feet north, hundreds of yards south and southwest, and 400 feet down, with a worrisome shallow plume and a larger, deeper one seeping along of its own accord. Additionally, PCBs have been monitored in groundwater at more than 25% solubility at a depth of approximately 400 feet on the western bank of the western shore of the Hudson, across from Fort Edward. So again, the outfall pipe is on the eastern bank. These contaminants were found on the western bank. It means they totally underlie the river. The discovery of the 25% solubility of PCBs in the water there indicated the presence of non-aqueous phase liquid. This is pure PCB oil. It's as fresh as the day it is made. And sort of brings to mind the free-floating product plume Walter had talked about. That means they had migrated 1,300 feet underneath the Hudson and had been observed upwelling into the riverbed. That summer, I debated the merits of source removal, which Walter Hank believed Superfund law demanded, versus source control, what the EPA routinely settled for in practice, with Walter Mugden, the EPA Region 2 Superfund chief. Sometimes the perfect is the enemy of the good, and the law gives us mechanisms where we can fall short, where we can choose to fall short, he said. And there certainly might not be enough money on earth to do it. When I discussed source removal with Dave King, EPA's project manager at its Hudson Falls field office, he said, "Source removal? That's the size of this room, which, if memory serves, was about 15 feet by 30 feet. Not exactly a 200-mile Superfund site." A few weeks later, I spoke to an environmental engineer with first-hand knowledge of the situation in Hudson Falls and Fort Edward. He suggested that source removal for the plants would cause orders of magnitude more than the near billion-dollar dredging effort, and would transform the Hudson Falls site into a quarry 400 feet deep, several thousand feet long, and 1,000 feet wide, with a similar but smaller moonscape to be fashioned in Fort Edward. As early as 1991, this consultant said, the costs associated with source removal were considered so great that GE entertained the possibility of permanently diverting the river at Baker's Falls, above Hudson Falls and the two GE plants, Hudson Falls and Fort Edward, blasting a new permanent river channel through the town of Moreau. Now, obviously, they didn't do that. So what did they do? At Hudson Falls, DEC dug many dozens of exploratory wells, collected several miles of rock core, and removed over 100 tons of PCBs. Is that most of it? The project manager wondered aloud when he showed me around the plant sites. I can't tell you, he continued. How much oil is under Hudson Falls or Fort Edward? I don't know. It's just lots. We'll never know. We're never going to get all the oil out. Last summer, an underground drainage system meant to intercept PCBs migrating to the river went online, but Hang doubted whether its capture zone was large enough to contain all the known contaminated areas. The remedy is designed to address the entire mass of rock between the source and the river, said the project manager. So whether there's a pool under the pump house, under the smokestack, or under the flagpole, it doesn't matter, because I'm going to treat it like the whole thing's nuked, which it is. End quote. From the data furnished by DEC, which is publicly available, Hang determined the area of bedrock saturated with non-aqueous phase liquid, pure PCB oil, at Hudson Falls was nearly a half mile long, 1,100 feet wide, and roughly 400 feet deep. Furthermore, Hang established the plume partially dissolved PCBs, several acres in size, far surpassed the tunnel's reach. When I suggested this might be the case, DEC's project manager got defensive. I don't want to call it nitpicking, he said, but it's not important for us to know the plume size to the foot, because the scale of this problem is much larger than that. Could the plume be 50 feet further than we thought? Sure, absolutely. According to Hang, it's nearly 1,000. Walter's numbers matched up almost exactly with the consultant's recollections regarding the size of the pure PCB oil plume at Hudson Falls, so I have a high degree of confidence in his other findings as well. At Fort Edward, where PCB oil was identified in 1983, the infamous parking lot with 1.6 million pounds of PCBs beneath it has been diminished by about half, according to DEC. They don't seem hell-bent on draining the entire thing, only stopping its advance, even though, again, it abuts a residential neighborhood. At the former outfall pipe on the river's eastern bank, DEC oversaw the removal of 23,000 tons of contaminated material from 1,350 feet of shoreline, where PCBs leaked up from the fractured bedrock into the river bottom. When this effort was completed in 2004, the DEC project manager recalled that at that point, quote, it was easy to see we had a much bigger problem than we thought oil-wise, end quote. But for some reason, even though DEC has been hunting PCB oil at the site for 27 years, the source of the contamination has yet to be identified or cleaned up. Late last summer, while dredging was supposed to be hitting its peak production, I asked the consultant if PCBs were upwelling into the riverbed at Fort Edward. He said, gotta be. The problem is that both plant sites are upstream of the dredge area. Time and again, EPA has claimed that remediating GE's plant sites is crucial to the dredging success. Why then did the fact that both plants were still contributing to the PCB load in the river upstream of the dredge area not seem to bother anyone? The reason was that they all had unflinching faith in the water column sampling that was going on just above Rogers Island at the top of the Thompson Island pool, just a little ways downstream. But theirs was a curious consensus. Using water column samples to stop the foot shy of the riverbed, excluding anything seeping or rolling around the bottom, to assess the presence of a hydrophobic, generally insoluble compound that's 35% heavier than water seems specious and self-fulfilling. Quote, the only thing you can do is base it on the data you've got, said Dave Kane in response to these concerns. The DEC project manager conceded that, quote, it could be difficult indeed to capture the hypothetical droplet moving along the river bottom. If someone can develop a better understanding of how to measure PCB transport in this system, I would be pleased to hear from them. End quote. Everyone, in other words, everyone acknowledged the technique's limitations, but they still professed faith in its results, whether out of temerity or necessity. So, in summary, my piece sought to prove the following: that the contamination available for transport to the Hudson, extant beneath the plants, the towns, and the river itself, was far greater than previously acknowledged and remained almost entirely uncontrolled. As a result, the contamination of the river sediments in the Thompson Island pool and the amount of dense PCB oil or non-aqueous phase liquid tumbling along the river bottom might be vastly underestimated. Accordingly, the dredging project, which had targeted 40 sediment hotspots and only purported to remove 65% of the river's PCBs in the first place, might be inadequate and could, over time, be reversed. Further, I suggested that EPA's ecologically disingenuous characterization of what constituted the river, merely the area between the banks, not anything beneath or beside it, like G's plants, the ultimate sources of the contamination, and as well as EPA sloughing off of responsibility for these critical cleanups on DEC, could pose a problem. After all, DEC hadn't even been able to compel GE to take part or to pay for the removal of the contaminated shoreline near the Fort Edward outfall back in 2004. You and I voted up $9 million for that. So the reaction to the priest, to the piece was, you know, varied and extreme in some quarters. GE offered a so-called rebuttal, dubbed Harper's Folly, on its Hudson River Project website around November 12th of last year. GE took issue with my, quote, claim that their PCB discharges were illegal, which they clearly were under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 and the Refuse Act, which was passed in the same legislative stroke. GE contended that their, quote, use of PCBs was entirely legal. Note that use and discharge are entirely different things. Further, they professed absolute faith in the water column sampling that indicated the plant's current contribution to the Hudson's PCB load was minimal. They wrote, with EPA oversight and approval, GE investigated the potential that the current method for analyzing PCB levels in the water underrepresented PCBs that could be moving along the river bottom. This assertion was found to be inaccurate, and EPA agreed with that conclusion. Hence, the methodology did not change on the Hudson or elsewhere. GE removed that paragraph from their rebuttal a few days later. Apparently, they had second thoughts. Many people interpreted the thesis as anti-dredging, or anti-cleanup in general. And what I was actually advocating for was to have EPA roll the plant sites into the Superfund site so that a more vigorous and thorough remediation of the land-based sites overseen by the agency could coincide with phase two. Environmental groups were loath to embrace or endorse the findings because the battle over dredging had been so hard fought. They didn't want to give GE cause to delay or evade phase two of the cleanup. On the contrary, as headlines such as GE : magazine wrong, comma, cleanup working, and GE : Hudson Rebirth is a huge success demonstrate, my piece put GE in the awkward position of having to defend the very cleanup they had spent decades and $122 million fighting. Riverkeeper and Scenic Hudson, in particular, were unconvinced that the contamination was as extensive as that claim, or that it was an imminent threat to the river or the cleanup. Later, I realized that I had in my possession a Riverkeeper memo from the Pataki era, which states, today, Riverkeeper is pressing the federal government, i.e. the EPA, to designate Fort Edward and Hudson Falls as standalone Superfund sites. Yes, Riverkeeper forgot. As dredging wound down in November and the great data crunch began, EPA, GE, and the environmental consultants hired by each camp began to hash out the numbers to examine what worked and what didn't, so they could submit their findings to an independent peer review panel that would analyze the results and make recommendations for how phase two would be carried out. They pulled their phase one evaluation reports together by March, By late May, the panel said it wouldn't be able to parse the 1,000 plus pages that had been submitted and come up with a valid draft recommendations by their May 28th deadline. And so it was pushed back to July 21st, with their final report expected August 18th this year. Earlier, the panel had expressed frustration with the fact that GE and EPA had reached such widely diverging conclusions from the same data. One panelist observed that the two sides weren't, quote, reading from the same script, and they are not progressing forward with the same goals in mind, end quote. GE cited considerable resuspension of PCBs as a reason for a more, quote, targeted approach of dredging less PCBs in phase two and burying more with backfill. EPA contended that adjustments to dredging methods could be instituted to control the resuspension of PCBs while dredging more, not less. Phase two's time frame of 5 years became a major issue. It seemed likely to be extended. There were some encouraging words from members of the panel. The chairman, a private engineer from Washington State, said, "I don't see a reason to limit the project to 5 years. Making it longer might provide a benefit in the long term." GE spokesman Mark Beam characteristically spoke out of both sides of his mouth, saying the project, quote, is not a race, while the official company line was, GE said it favored completing the dredging project as quickly as possible. When I actually got around to surveying EPA's findings in preparation for this talk, I felt that my efforts over much of the last year had been validated. In the phase one dredge area, which is a mere 10% of the project, EPA expected to find 265,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment. And they actually encountered 360,000. So they're off by over a third. Out of the 18 certification units that the phase one area was divided into, they only dredged 10. That's 48 of 88 acres. In the 10 certification units dredged, they'd anticipated 11,000 kilograms of PCB mass. However, they actually found 20,000, 80% more than anticipated, the equivalent of what they'd expected to find in all 18 certification units combined. The main problem, according to the EPA, an inaccurate estimate of the depth of the contamination. Apparently, those 50,000 sediment cores they constantly referenced didn't make them as omniscient as they supposed. Further, EPA claimed that the relevance and consequences of uncertainty in the depth of contamination measurements was a point of disagreement between EPA and GE over the course of the remedial design. They continued, in light of GE's concerns about cost effectiveness, EPA allowed GE flexibility to manage the uncertainty. Phase one results support EPA's warnings regarding the depth of contamination, as the average thickness of additional dredging required was greater than 1 foot and was up to 13 feet. The river's about 4 feet deep. This area, this reach. So, also, depending on the flow. Also, EPA revealed that PCB-bearing oils were released from the sediments during dredging in several areas, and that PCBs in the dredging area generally were dominated by dissolved phase and NAPL phase, which is the non-aqueous phase liquid. They noted, quote, the presence of free product oil. You'll recall that in our first conversation, Walter Hang indicated the presence of a, quote, free floating product plume beneath Hudson Falls. EPA went on to note that, quote, there was little evidence of the presence of such oils prior to the start of dredging during phase one. I beg to differ. They further advised that PCB-bearing oil releases should be anticipated during phase two. Basically, the sediment cores had no vertical reference, so the depth of contamination couldn't be accurately gauged, so multiple dredge passes were required in each spot, causing the very resuspension that GE wants to use as a justification for dredging less PCBs from the river, even though they encountered orders of magnitude more than expected. One of the major cleanup costs is space in the Texas landfill where the Hudson sediments will have their final resting place. So that's clearly a motivating factor for GE. Hopefully, the panel will call for a far more thorough investigation of the river bottom, so this can be avoided in phase two. Who knows, they may even trace the source back to the plumes emanating from beneath the plants. In July, GE finally lost its marathon legal crusade against the constitutionality of the Superfund law. Specifically, the agency's power to compel cleanups by issuing unilateral administrative orders in non-emergency situations. GE isn't participating in the Hudson River cleanup because of a UAO, but it has been issued UAOs in 68 other instances. It could potentially be levied with one in another 79 cleanups. The concern was that if GE won their case, EPA wouldn't be able to compel them to go along with phase two via the threat of continuing with the cleanup while suing GE for treble damages. Also, the Obama administration recently announced its intent to reinstate excise taxes on oil and other polluting industries that Congress let expire in 1995. This may finally allow for an adequately resourced Superfund program, i.e., one with enough money to go ahead with the cleanup should GE balk. So there are no sure things in this scenario, but the outlook for dredging going forward is pretty good. What will happen upstream is another matter. One thing we should all bear in mind, however, is that the more PCBs that are removed, the better off the ecosystem will be in the long term, and the healthier will be as Hudson Valley residents. One only needs to spend some time talking to Dr. David Carpenter, the director of SUNY Albany's Institute for Health and the Environment, to understand the implications of what GE's done to our valley. Quote, studies that I've done along the Hudson have been looking at the rates of disease, cardiovascular maladies, myocardial infarction, stroke, hypertension, diabetes, and respiratory ailments of people living in zip codes adjacent to the river, says Carpenter. And they are statistically significant, very, very elevated. This is both troubling and mysterious, given the Hudson Valley residents lead healthier than lifestyles are healthier than the nation at large. We smoke less, spend more time outdoors, and consume more fruits and vegetables on average than our statistical peers. The major exposure pathway EPA based its human health risk assessment on, and the entire dredging project around, was the ingestion of fish. But as Dr. Carpenter points out, this does little but clarify the alarming rates of various diseases related to persistent organic pollutants, like PCBs, found in Hudson River Valley residents. The people fishing in the Hudson aren't defined by those living next to it, Carpenter observes. Fishermen will go anywhere, so it's very unlikely they all live right by the river. Inhalation, not fish consumption, is the only logical explanation for how these people are being exposed. While the preponderance of PCB-contaminated sediment and highly contaminated fish are found upriver, GE's toxins affect the entire valley, including Green and Columbia counties. PCBs in the river from Hudson Falls to the Battery over time become weathered, losing a few of their chlorine molecules to bacteria or through various chemical processes, and thus volatilize, evaporate into a gas more readily. PCBs go into the air, and you can be exposed to them every day by breathing them in, Carpenter continues. They're more readily metabolized, they can do their harmful effects without accumulating, so the body burden is less, but that doesn't mean they're without effects. We're finding that these very low chlorinated PCBs are extremely toxic. Just because you can't measure huge levels doesn't mean they don't contribute to disease, and the list of maladies related to PCB exposure grows constantly. Carpenter says that his evidence is very strong that non-cancer endpoints are orders of magnitude more important than cancer, which is easy to measure. You either have it or you don't. Subtle differences in IQ, thyroid hormone levels, these are much more difficult to quantify, but they're very well documented in just about every population that's been studied. The evidence for relation with diabetes is now overwhelming, says Carpenter. Hudson River PCBs have been identified in the Arctic, and if the atmospheric transport system is carrying them there, it's safe to assume they're swirling around our towns as well. Dredging alone won't stop this. Once again, both GE and EPA admit PCB pollution in the Hudson is far greater than previously believed. Their remedy was only going to exhume 65% of the prior inadequate estimate, a paltry sum in retrospect that already ignored the immense scale of land-based contamination beneath Hudson Falls and Fort Edward. We, the ones who are most at risk, need to summon new reserves of outrage, and demand that our representatives hold GE accountable for the fresh damage their past heedlessness does each day. Justice deferred may be justice denied, but if there's will enough in time, we might rehabilitate the river and a little of ourselves along the way. Thank you, guys.
Transport them so far. That's a huge expense, and it's an environmental danger also in the transport. So why aren't they figuring out a way to dispose of them somehow closer?
Well, this was a big impediment to the cleanup all along. The DEC tried to site a landfill in Fort Edward multiple times. They showed up at people's farms saying, we're taking X amount of your land, signing up the dotted line. And didn't make people very happy, and that caused a lot of the antagonism between upriver folks and downriver folks. And basically, GE was left to find another alternative. Nobody wants to burn them. Thermal oxidation, you know, is supposed to be pure, complete, 99.69s out. But when you deal with a huge volume, what's left on the remainder becomes a big number. We simply don't have a lot of good ways to do this. I mean, burying them is not ideal, especially burying them in this particular Texas landfill, which many people believe is hydrologically connected to the Ogallala Aquifer, which supplies 30% of the irrigated water used for irrigation in this country. But PCBs are the least harmful thing going in this landfill. There's tons of nuclear material in it. So anyway, there are environmental concerns, obviously, with transport. But Walter Mugden, the Superfund chief for Region 2, would tell you that they're not allowed to interfere with interstate commerce. That GE wanted to do this, and it would be a usurpation or some kind of violation to interfere with interstate commerce. So they are being transported there in rail cars, specially made rail cars. I think there are 80 some odd rail cars or something like that.
Do they come through here?
There's a cross there? I don't think they come through here. But they're supposedly sealed. I mean, the sediments are dewatered up on a facility that GE built. It's about a 100-acre facility on the Shadoff Block 7, the Champlain Canal. It's got a water treatment system big enough for a town one-tenth the size of Saratoga. And the sediments that have been dredged go there. The water is squeezed out of them, they're turned into a filter tank, and then they're put on rail cars, and the rail cars are sealed up, and they go to Andrews County, Texas.
And they're welcome there.
They're welcome there. But, again, the Sierra Club objects, but they're all summarily overruled.
So there are only two ways of disposing of them?
Well, see, this is the problem with polluter pays. I mean, polluter pays principle is great, but it also sort of stymies innovation in remedial efforts, because nobody wants to shell out for the high-end model. And there used to be a program through Superfund called the SITES program, which encouraged innovation. But apparently, I've just been told stories time and time again about when a company had a new novel thing, real innovation that could do some good, companies that were responsible for the contamination would come in and buy the company, and suddenly that project would be over. Mm-hmm. And so the lesson that I've learned or gleaned from all this is that we have to stop these things before they happen, that we're really piss poor in dealing with them after they do happen. Sometimes around Hudson Falls and Fort Edward, I just felt, I knew from the person who I was with, they said, you're breathing in PCBs right now. and I knew consciously that I was, and that they could smell them. So I was, I know that I probably, was exposed a little bit, but I think, again, we're all exposed. People warned me, there are all these, people said, oh, gee, they're scaring people, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't encounter anything. What?
No thugs coming in.
No, nothing like that. No Michael Clayton stuff or anything.
You said that we have a measurable amount of PCBs in this. You're fairly sure of that. But yet, you are unable to measure, we are unable to measure the amount of PCBs in our regenerative.
That's not exactly true. There's a distinction. PCBs that are heavily chlorinated do bioaccumulate, and they can be measured. It's called a body burden. It's because they store in your fatty tissues. They're lipophilic chemicals or compounds, so they want to be with fat. They're hydrophobic, so they're afraid of water. They're insoluble, but they're lipophilic, so they do seek out fatty tissues, and they can be measured in your serum lipid levels. They can be measured. But the less chlorinated ones don't store in the fat. So they're, the ones that are heavily chlorinated, we can measure, but the ones that are more transient, the less chlorinated ones, pass through your system.
So we're basically unable to tell from these measurements if people who live on the river are in a more dangerous situation than people who live in Windham, for example.
It is harder to tell, but again, you look at, Dr. Carpenter has done these studies by zip code, and he looks at emissions, for specific, conditions. And then he cross-references or, judges that, balances that, weighs that against national, indices.
And just one more follow-up to that. How does what happens here in Hudson Valley compare to other parts of our culture, to Chicago, for example, or Arkansas?
I mean, the fact that, this river is a tidal estuary up until the federal dam in Troy, means that it contracts, expands, so the water recedes and it advances, and it's left to dry in the sun, evaporate. So it really is a literal engine for the dispersal of these toxins.
Especially
PCBs.
So
I have another question.
Yes.
Another kind of answer to that question.
Okay.
That I wanted to just really a question for you. How is what happens here compared to Chicago? I was listening to you, and I've been obsessed with the oil spill.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just change the names, change the EPA regions.
Yeah,
there's nothing different about this story. It was substance.
Right.
That was more immediate. It could take 30 years
right.
to figure out that there's a problem. We can see it, we can smell it. PCBs were a little bit more invisible.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that what happens here is happening everywhere, depending upon scale, etc.
I think that's largely true. I mean, there are 47,000 hazardous waste sites in the country. One in four of us live within 3 miles of a hazardous waste site, and half of us live within 10 miles of a Superfund site. So it is. Yes. So we're all very close to sources. From what I've seen, it really depends on what kind of people you have in office, what kind of bureaucracies you have. Silicon Valley, for instance, had 29 Superfund sites at one time, the most of any county in America. And they were largely due all to underground storage containers that chip makers used to store chemicals related to chip making. By all accounts, I wanted to go out there and do a story, but by all accounts, the issue is being handled. The companies out there sent their engineers to the first meetings, first sign of trouble, and not their attorneys. So maybe it's California culture. Maybe it's you have progressive, technology-driven, non-dinosaur industries out there.
You meant handled, not enforced.
What?
You meant handle
documents. No. I contacted reporters out there and activists out there. And the one activist I talked to, their biggest concern was the EPA wasn't shelling out money to refurbish an old building. So I think it really depends. It's uneven. EPA Region 5 in Chicago, I think it's probably worse than Region 2.
Region DEC is
2.
DEC 2.
EPA. DEC is just the whole state. EPA Region 2 is here, as far as I know. New York State DEC is just New York State. Oh, we're reading court? Okay.
How did these things get into the apartment in the first place? I mean, I guess it was legal.
No, it was not legal. Was not legal. They
like
described
it as a hole that just dumps the stuff out.
Yeah, they had.
Why is it so inefficient? Why is so much of it?
Well, this wasn't the. PCBs weren't the project, the product that GE was making. And the way they treated it, they're making capacitors in these two plants. And apparently they must have been very cheap. They received them in large tanker cars. They came up from Anniston, Alabama. And they unloaded them in the railroad offload area, just spill everywhere, terrible housekeeping. And these capacitors are very little things. They had a practice called flood filling, which is you just took a handful or a bunch of capacitors, put them in the PCBs until the bubbles stopped coming out. And then you took them out, washed them off with TCE, which is another harmful chemical. And this all took place in Hudson Falls in this sort of basement area of Building 1. And Building 1 was an old pulp and paper mill that was owned by the Union Bag Company. And this area where this was going on was designed as was supposed to be an air plenum, which is would circulate the balmy air from the paper mill into the basement. And the problem is that it was just carved into the bare rock. There was no proper foundation on the place. And so all of this was going on right on top of this highly fractured Snake Hill Shale, which is just, has fissures in it throughout. And it's sort of, people I talked to said it was the worst case scenario. Like, this is the worst place this could go on, in terms of environmental, in terms of having it spread, having the problem get worse, kind of scenario. And,
do you know anything about what happened to the workers?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's really highly disputed. I mean, a lot of people think there were studies done that were damning, and there were studies done that, made it look like, oh, nothing's wrong, and people said, oh, well, they were counting front office workers and not just these people, but people in Pittsfield, they're just horror stories, and they're just stories of people dying horrible deaths. I toured Fort Edward with a gentleman named Dennis Prebo, who grew up on Putnam Ave, right across from the gates of the plant. And he, it's all anecdotal, but he would just say, brain cancer, brain cancer, brain cancer, the whole street. And just because they weren't the same specific type of cancer, they didn't count as a cluster. And so, but there's never been, a comprehensive study of people up here with PCB exposure. But they are starting one, or they have one ongoing in Anniston, Alabama, which is where Monsanto made these chemicals. And the ATSDR, which is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. Yep, they're sort of part of the Superfund program. Their job is to evaluate health risks at Superfund sites. The problem is they've been charged, basically outed as serially minimizing these risks. Most recently at Camp Lejeune, there was, water quality issue. And they were basically brought before Congress, and I think the director was fired. And so they're the people doing that study. But
do they have sufficient staff, sufficient funds to do a sufficient knowledge to do it?
It's tough because, people like Dr. Carpenter are on the forefront of, studying PCB toxicity. I have, the EPA has risk metrics, that they use, this program called IRIS, where they're supposed to, look at their risk models and update them in light of new studies, etc. I asked the EPA in Washington to put me in touch with the person in charge of that. They couldn't produce them.
Can I ask you what people ask questions? Just repeat your question.
Okay.
I was surprised when you said that human health risk assessments indicate myocardial infarction, diabetes, breathing problems, because I've always associated them with the cancers you said, and
right.
still,
brain cancer.
Right. So, what kind of correlation is he finding? Just a geographic correlation with increased MI, diabetes, and other.
I don't have his most current and detailed findings, but again, cancer is like a binary thing. Again, either you have it or you don't. And it is rare within the population anyway. He's saying that these subtle differences are more prevalent, they believe. And also, I think the simplification of PCBs and, in this whole, in cancer and PCBs, this whole debate started with GE's massive, propaganda campaign, possibly, upriver, where they, anytime they're in a forum or anytime, PCBs do not cause cancer. And anytime someone else got up there and said, well, they are probably, anytime your argument exceeded that word count, you had already lost.
That's a good propaganda metric.
Yeah, limit your
word
count.
Yeah. Length is weakness.
Right.
The subsequence is propaganda power.
Yeah.
Can I ask what kind of super fund GE has for taking care of this? Like, we have $20 billion. Probably will run out. Is there a super fund set aside from BP or from GE to clean this up?
They have a. They're probably putting aside funds. It's costing them people like $1 billion.
Are they preparing paperwork for foreclosure?
No, I don't think so. I think they're still in business. They're still making huge poodles of money. They paid no taxes last year. Zero.
I've got a couple comments to make. I worked in one of the upcoming seminars that Lake has met. And we're talking about this stuff. I've been working on this.
Been working with HRI, and
that?
Even in Lenox, Mass. You said?
Oh, I've been working on environmental issues since 1985.
Okay.
In private industry.
Okay.
One thing they talk about, all right? You got GE plastics right above the cement plant. The cement plant has a permit to burn the hazardous waste they generate. A few years ago, they put in for a permit to burn tall hazardous waste. And I got invited to the conference for humanity and brought out some facts that wasn't generally known.
Right.
Now it's the forest cement company. The forest is the biggest burner of hazardous waste in the world. Now, there's something you ought to know about the forest. Whether it's the Atlantic cement, the Blue Circle cement, or the Ford cement, that should be called New York State cement. Because in 1958 was the last nationwide cement strike. In 1958, they were finishing up the New York State freeway. And all of a sudden, they couldn't buy any cement. What happened was, they went to Pennsylvania and found a cement company that had been out of business for a number of years, but had a lot of clinker stored outside. You can't use outside stored clinker because it doesn't grind up the way a cubic weight per foot has gone through. So what they've done is they shot through it. Alright? Right after that, they started a study to bring a cement company in that would take care of everything for the state. buy-in for climate summit, Peter Noonan. Who was Peter Noonan? Peter Noonan was Polly Noonan's husband. It was Polly Noonan. She was Mayor Corning's personal secretary for eons, okay? That cement company up there is New York State Cement. Ever since we've been in manufacturing things, we've been building the New York City number 3 water tunnel in New York City, okay? Guess who supplies all the cement in New York State for the number 3 water tunnel? Atlantic Cement. No competitive effect from them. That is a state-owned cement company. We believe and everything else should not offer that. Okay. We have a permit to burn what hazardous waste we generate. We used to burn oil back in 73 when we started burning oil. Oil prices come along and run off the oil and pack the coal. Okay? Periodically, what oil we were supposed to be burning with the oil from this former equipment is quarry.
That's right. There's going to be a presentation on this next time.
August 8th.
August 8th, we're going to be talking about the Farge.
August 8th?
Yeah. August 8th. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Question, Beth?
Do you know of any good websites that have tracks?
I don't know if, Walter Hang's site has a lot of information. It's toxicstargeting.com. He's asking if there are any sites which you can use to sort of find out where a lot of contamination is. His site is actually really disconcerting. It's very thorough. You can track, literally, if you go to Manhattan, it's like there's nowhere that there hasn't been spilled. So you can, everywhere in the state, every hazardous release, you can document it. In terms of in the river, if you want to get an idea of where the hot spots are that they're dredging, or where they had hits of air quality during the dredging, the EPA's website is good. Their specific Hudson River dredging site is good. Also, there's a community advisory group, which the EPA helps create. It's a community group that it's like the bridge to the community at every Superfund site. So there is a community advisory group site for the Hudson River, which also has a lot of good documents on it. And that'll lead you to the pertinent, anytime somebody from the DEC gives a presentation to the community advisory group, there'll be a link to it, and you'll know what data was presented. And so that's a good one-stop place for that kind of material. Indian Point. Riverkeeper is really, they're really good. Their website, you can go there. In terms of water quality and bacteria or microbes, anything like that, you can go right to Riverkeeper's site, and it has all the information there. Because John Lipscomb, the Riverkeeper, patrols, as much as he can, logs thousands of miles every year. So that's a good resource.
Jim.
Yeah, David. In terms of you said the final report is going to be coming out in August?
August 18th.
And now, once everything gets going, let's assume that some type of actual physical action starts to take place, based on the numbers, the higher numbers that you've cranked and the other gentlemen have cranked, what does all that mean for right out that window? What's going to happen here when things start happening?
Well, in a typical year, you get 500 pounds of PCBs over the federal dam at Troy, transferred from the upper river to the lower river. And it's like the normal ambient, whatever conditions. During the dredging, that could go up, especially if there's more to dredge. It looks like GE and EPA are pretty far apart on adjustments, it seems to me like GE wants to bury more. EPA wants to dredge more, and the more you dredge, the benefit of the project, which EPA, sort of foresaw, was a reduction in the concentration of fish, and that was always thought to spike in the near term if you dredge, and over the 60-year time horizon that probabilistic models go out to, it would eventually decline. And, you know, you would expect, talking to Walter Mugden, you know, they had this model, it starts out with a big spike, and then it, starts to coincide with this other thing that's more gradual, and it wraps around it. And that other line is doing nothing. And it's tricky because, Walter Mugden, the Superman chief, said, with dredging, the PCB levels are almost always better than not dredging. So there are times when it is worse when you're going to dredge, but ultimately, as long as they're in the river and available at some point to be resuspended or volatilized, it's a problem. GE wants to bury them, but how long do they stay buried? And if you have a 100-year event in terms of a flood or a storm, or we had a tornado in Bridgeport the other day, so
there's a because there are PCBs in the bottom of the river all the way down to like Constitution Island,
all the way down, especially in
Marsh
River.
So now there's a project that I've done a couple stories on, and I'm curious. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. So if you're not, then the question ends right there. There's a high voltage DC power line, the Champlain Hudson Power Express, that's coming from Canada down the Yonkers.
Wants to,
and they want to bury the two pairs of cables.
Two or four, right?
Well, it's four cables, two pair.
Okay.
They're doing that.
Right.
And they want to do that from Queemans on down. They're going to come through the Champlain and then the canal, but then when they get to the hot spot, they're going to go around the railroad tracks and then come back into Queemans and go on down the river. They show this nice little video of this underwater trencher just going along, kicking up. It looks like a beach at Bahama underwater.
Right.
I mean, it's perfect soil, no mud, no anything, and perfect sand. So, I guess, what's your feeling about a resuspension from that action? Is that going to make a problem?
I mean, it will definitely happen. You'll definitely get resuspension. The only reason they're doing that is because fish don't vote.
Okay.
And they want to turn the Hudson, and that's what someone in the industry said, right, as a matter of fact.
On Tuesday, today being Saturday, on Tuesday in Kingston is the public informational hearing on that project to take input for the scope of the draft EIS.
Right.
I'm hoping to go down there. I don't know. I might have to do a town hall board meeting, but have you been attending to any of their things?
I haven't, but I discussed this with John Lipscomb just the other day.
Okay.
And he assured me that, no one has ever studied the effects of having like a 2,000 megawatt cable going through a fishery, going through a nursery, going through a spawning ground.
Yeah.
It's never been studied. The company has pledged to study it.
Yeah.
I don't know how much faith you put in that. I don't know how you test for that either. How do you set up the control experiment for that? But, John was beside himself about it. We've done this river wrong so many times.
Yeah.
And here we have another, opportunity that's like right in our face. And
yes,
it looks like, we're gonna grab and take hold of it. It's always the excuse, that, New York City needs the power. That was the excuse for Indian Point.
Yeah.
Will they have like something like 10 square miles of roof space, in Manhattan?
Solar,
why don't they put
power,
solar panels all over it?
The other part of this is that their original plan was to come from Maine down across, and there was land that they had, a constitutional amendment in Maine they couldn't get, so that's when they picked up, because they wanted to serve Boston in the east of Massachusetts, and that's for the purpose of the second line. They came up with the second plan, one to run the Yonkers, which really doesn't need it, I don't think, and the second one goes on across the Sound up into Bridgeport, so it can feed Connecticut and there. And I just, my concern is that we're still trying to solve the problems above Albany in the river.
Right.
And to suddenly start digging down in here, at the same time, they're going to be pointing fingers and saying, it's not us, they caused it.
Right.
Well,
I think the thing to do is, John was telling me that he was just down in D.C. Talking with a lobbyist, and he said that these days, if a politician gets, five handwritten letters, the mass mailings don't count anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if they get handwritten letters, it scares them. Mm-hmm. And so if people want to stop You know, it doesn't, doesn't matter whether it's a Vic or a Mont Blanc, you know. Go ahead and paper. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just was curious, when you dealt with Walter Mugden, what was his attitude toward the land-based cleanup as being separate? He didn't believe that that needed to be remediated?
He felt that it was a good use of resources, to use the state resources, and that they were doing fine and we were keeping tabs on it, but I could tell that, you know, he wasn't keeping as close watch on it as, you know, he should have maybe, or he might, you know, I don't know. He seemed kind of, there was a lot of new information that I think I delivered to him when I met him.
So it's curious, because I just moved from Brooklyn, and the Gowanus is the number one toxic waterway in the country. And it's a waterway as wide as this room, and I lived like a half of it. I could spit it. And Walter is in charge of that cleanup, and he is adamant about the land cleanup happening at the same time.
Well, I mean, it's almost indistinguishable. It's like the old cogen.
It's not land that's just flanking the waterway. It's well upland, and same thing. You know, it can be working its way down through the neighborhoods underground. So it's blocks and blocks away in an upland area. But my other question about Walter and thinking that, you know, whatever, someone else is taking care of that. I know these state agencies and these federal agencies, they don't really talk to each other. So, you know, they can just be chasing their tail around in different circles. But, oh, hold on.
It's in there.
Right in the fog. Oh, so the other thing is, why is the GE even such a party to the, I mean, if they're the bad guys, why are they telling us what needs to be happening? Why isn't the EPA saying, we're charging you X amount because this needs to happen? Why are they even consulting them as an equal partner so much? Why do they have so much say?
Because, you know, we're a nation of laws, but we're a nation of laws that are often compromised as they're written by lobbyists and people in the chemical lobby. And Superfund isn't a perfect law. And, you know, Superfund EPA asked to... somewhere in there, it says they have to, what they approve has to be cost effective, you know, and that's general enough for someone like General Electric to, you know, raise issues about. And unless they want to, levy a unilateral administrative order, then sort of it's a debate, it's a discussion, lots of lawyers in the room.
It's compromise.
Yeah, it's compromise, compromises. He's asked me to elaborate on, you know, PCB oil, what it's like. I never saw it. I smelled it. I was told someone told me it smelled like geraniums.
Tastes like chicken.
I was in the water on the river going down by some of these places and saw that some of the caps were open in some of the wells. And immediately, you know, you started to get, I mean, there's tons of other stuff down there. But to me, it smelled like a tire fire. It was like you got a headache, you got nauseous, it's really, really nasty stuff. And these workers used to speak, coated with it. You know, the guys who were flood filling the capacitors used to, they needed new shoes every couple of weeks. They got chloracne, which is a terrible acne condition. Walter Hang was telling me that he was looking for some sites up near Glens Falls where people had taken scrap capacitors to, like, get the copper out in their backyards. And, they got, PCBs all over the place. And he's talking to these people and saying, asking them, where was this? Or, where was this site? And they couldn't remember a thing. These people were just like, they were like the perfect victims.
No brainwashing.
They couldn't even remember the crime. So,
oh my God.
They're, I mean, they were probably present in such, you know, small quantities when I was driving around with this DEC official, and he could smell them and I couldn't. But, you know, again, he said it's smelling geraniums. I have no idea what that means.
So GE had evidence that there was a very toxic reaction, at least on the skin, for a good long time, right?
Oh, there's an article. It was actually a transcribed forum in the Journal of Industrial Hygiene, 1937.
Right.
Where they're just like, yeah, they're all like the Halifax Corporation, somebody from Monsanto, somebody from GE, and they're laughing about, you know, oh, the workers were getting yellow atrophy of the liver, and oh, isn't it funny how the workers get syphilis too, and, you know, those little scamps, you know, and somebody, one of the other participants asked, should we be doing, experiment on, you know, the effects of the workers? And one of the other guys chimed in, well, in effect, we're doing an experiment right now. So, yeah, they knew. Yeah. But they'll still dispute it today.
I just wanted to say one thing. For those who haven't read David's article, it's really good. Aside from speaking. Oh, sorry. For those who haven't read David's article, aside from everything else, it's a really good primer on EPA, DEC, and industry, and how they kind of interact or develop and stuff. I think we can agree that our well-intentioned people and smart people involved in these agencies and stuff. And there's also lies, obfuscation, that sort of stuff as well. But at its most dire, you describe the cleanup, and I'm paraphrasing, as appearing to be a confidence game in which the EPA loudly demanded dredging in an attempt to retain the public trust while settling for a half measure, and GE ably playing the foil, then acquiescing to pass itself off as a good corporate citizen. So I'm wondering, who do you consider the good guys, aside from the people sitting here who are concerned, and who should be writing letters, and that'll be, you know, I wanted to ask what we can do specific to this. I mean, Susan is going to talk about something else on the 8th, so,
right.
But we've all written our letters.
I think EPA desperately does need to appear trenchant and effective, and they really have been hamstrung. The tax that funded the Superfund was allowed to expire in 1995, and they've been running, you know, just on appropriations, basically since then. And they also have, they don't have enough fingers to put in the dike at this point. Again, 47,000 sites around the country. And again, they're wielding a law that isn't perfect either, you know. So they are sort of, it's got to be an absurd situation to find yourself in. And of course, you know, decisions get made. Bonnie Bello, who I quoted the piece, was very angry, thought she had been denigrated in some way. I read another book in which she was denigrated much more. I think they're well-intentioned people. I just think the EPA are sort of, it is an absurd situation. I mean, the proliferation of these sites, and 47,000 are just the ones that have been identified. Who knows how many haven't been, but, you know, obviously, you know, when you look at how GE has acted over the years, it's hard not to take sort of a Manichean worldview. But again, you know, you meet these people and they don't have, you know, small mustaches and jackboots. They're average people. I mean, Mark Meehan, the spokesman for GE, I guess, he worked at the city desk in a paper up in either Albany or somewhere, you know, up north of here in the Capital District. And, you know, jovial, amiable, affable, but, you know, it depends on what you think of what, you know, what kind of work GE is doing, you know, and how it's being spun, how the whole eco-imagination.
Yes.
Do you think that the EPO is going right now, that helps to like, make it easier to raise issues like this?
He asked, because of the, in light of the BP oil spill, does this make it easier to raise other environmental other environmental issues, or do they just get blotted out? And it's tough. I think you bring up other issues. I mean, I think that is sort of, you know, there are bright objects inferred around the sun, but you never even see them. It is sort of, you know, dominating national discourse, at least this part of the national discourse, because, you know, it speaks to fossil fuels and all this other stuff. But again, I think it makes it easy, because you see that something was done, and it can't be undone. We don't have the ability to undo these things. And so, like, that message, I think he can use, and use that sort of to apply to these other things. You know, everything, I think, is definitely taking a back seat. But I think, you know, it'll give everything currency, you know, if you sort of are able to connect the dots. And of course, that helps. You know, this is an example that everyone will be able to hit, and everyone will know what you're talking about. Thank you.
I know your article is still somewhat recent, but have you heard from anyone outside of the area or anyone who's not a major stockholder in this project about something that may be going on in Oregon or in, you know, Iowa that is any type of has any type of resemblance to what's going on here?
In terms of severity or in terms of a river or in terms
in terms of someone writing saying, this makes me think more about a project going on in my town, or a company saying, ooh, this makes me think a little bit more about what we're about to do here or what we did there, that kind of response.
No, I haven't gotten any kind of response like that. It would be nice though. Yeah.
That's about to be a disaster.
Another impending disaster.
Are there sites that have been documented that have been successfully cleaned up?
There are sites that have been delisted. Meaning that they, you know, are no longer on the national priorities list, and people are content, that standards or the goals of the cleanup were met, and they, are up to code. You know, they wanted to end up with this much, level of contamination, and they achieved that. I'm sure there have been many successful cleanups, but there are tons of really glaring failures. There are communities that have just been relocated. Where did they move them out? All over.
We can look at the EPA and the EPC as being good guys, and I totally agree that there are many lovely people in all of these regulatory and policy setting agencies, but having just in this area, in this geographic area alone, having worked on several issues with the DEC, with the Department of Health, there's two things kind of that conspire against the public and satisfying public concerns. One is the kind of being hamstrung by some of the laws that are imperfect, and the bureaucracy, and also people who have to work in that bureaucracy or choose to work in that bureaucracy for 25 or 30 years and get jaded and get hostile. I have had DEC project managers say to me, I'm glad I don't live where you live. You people are really annoying. You're always against them. And when I said, don't we have the right to find out what's happening to us? Doesn't that help you? And he said to me, no, you make my job more difficult.
And I think it's true that with a situation like this, it goes on forever.
Right.
And the other side, the company, they're the same people. And so they interact with the regulators over a long period of time. Citizens get exhausted. That's not our job. We have to earn a living. We get frustrated. We turn away. And so in the end, they have a more long-standing relationship with these people. And also, DEC, they've sort of had an Orwellian name for a while. We're all about issuing licenses for fish and game. They weren't about conserving anything for a long time. And they were complicit in GE's pollution the whole way, and they was acknowledged in 1976.
They continue to be complicit in other pollution as well.
No doubt. Last one? Okay.
so it's going to get back to me, it just let out of my brain. It has to do with laws. You're talking about bureaucracy, and the bureaucracies, the agencies interacting with the public, and I guess my question is, in your research and interviewing and just, going in depth into the an environmental problem like this, are there any changes in law? Because nothing gets done, nothing gets changed until the elected officials grab onto a problem.
Right.
And so have you heard of anything positive coming down the pipe in any, whether it's with in terms of I don't want to say PCBs particularly because that would be too micro-focused, and I don't want to say, oil with BP because that's too large, but is there any sentiment changing anywhere, either in Albany or in Washington, that you've run across in terms of we need to start having things more under a tighter control? Because the agencies are only as good as the laws, and they are filled with people who've been there for a number of years. Have you heard any? Is there any hope?
I guess about that. Well, I think right now there is some. Lisa Jackson, who's the head of the EPA, was a former hazardous waste engineer here in Region 2, and she worked mostly in New Jersey. But since she has become the administrator of the EPA, they declared their first site to be a public health emergency, and that had never been done before. And it took a lot of people dying in Libby, Montana, to make it happen. But it happened.
What was that site?
It's an old vermiculite mine.
And
asbestosis. And cancer. Yeah. Hundreds of people.
I think we're going to have to wrap up. You can probably, we should probably give David a break. But you can probably quorum in somewhere for a few questions. I'm curious, before we run off, first of all, we have refreshments for you. We have lemonade, and we have a lot of cookies, and we have water. And I guarantee you it's cooler outside. But we're curious, the friends are curious how some of you, because a lot of you are new, and we're curious how you found out about these lectures. I know that the press has been good to us on this, and I know we sent out a big mailing, but please, if you are not if you can give your email list to us, please give it to Todd or someone here so that we can send you further things, because this is the first of three series, and we have another one on July 10th, July 18th, and then on August 8th. And then we start with concerts in the fall. We have Bard concerts here. There will probably be four conservatory concerts that will be starting in October. So we're more than doing this. We're a wide range of things. And we want you to be part of this. So please, if you can give us information, that would be great. And enjoy yourself. And thank you for coming today. And thank you, David.
Thank you.